So, ladies and gentlemen, I have a special guest today, and I'm very excited for you to tune in and hear this podcast interview that I have with Mr. J. Andrew Brewer, aka Andy Brewer of Huber Brewer Construction Co. Andy, if you will, please just give a slight introduction of yourself to the people. First, I want to dig into your life just a little bit, obviously. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Huber Brewer Construction.
Absolutely. I proudly represent, alongside my brother Charlie, the sixth generation of the business since 1872. So 151 years this year, which I think is very seldom said amongst family businesses and continuity of family business. But as you know, we are locally here in Syracuse. Our world headquarters is right on the south side where it's always been, off of Colvin Street on Berwyn Avenue. We've been doing, construction management primarily in this business in this industry for the better part of 150 years overall. But I'll say that the Huber Brewer that people I think identify with today really started with where my father kind of elevated the company in late 80s, early 90s, with some, big flagship construction management opportunities, general contracting opportunities, probably starting with some great work at St. Joe's Hospital. One of those really breakthrough projects that put us on the map. We don't really self-perform anything in terms of hard labor, which is, I think, a common misconception. I think people think we're a larger organization in terms of manpower than we are. But the reality is that we're really a group of, 60 to 90 administrators and managers, very, very limited field staff, but we manage construction management projects, general construction projects, design, build, and development opportunities throughout largely, 100 mile radius of Syracuse. Occasionally outside of that zone, but that's really our power alley.
Wonderful. And some of the type of projects that you guys do or focus on are like universities, hospitals, you mentioned St. Joe's, and what else?
It's funny. I think because we are maybe more geographically and community focused, we're not necessarily wed to a sector or a type of project so much as we're wed to the region.
Right.
And as a result, we end up being a little bit of a chameleon. There's ebbs and flows to, to investment and spending. Certainly nowadays, people, I think, would associate Huber Brewer is doing a lot of the purpose-built student housing and multifamily housing. But there was a while where we were doing a lot more senior living. There was a while we were doing a lot more hospitality, hotel work, and academic work, parking garages, medical. Like I say, it tends to come and go sometimes based on where there are hotbeds of that investment in this community. And we tend to look for the best opportunities in this community rather than saying, well, we do student housing and we do it well and we're going to do it all over the Northeast. We want to know what's coming down the pipe in this community and think about ways that we weave into that, dovetail with that. It's not only, I think, a methodology that's served us well, but I think it kind of just reflects the dynamic of our company culture and of our commitment to our people.
Yes.
We don't want to be that company that's insisting on people flying to Boston every week. We tend to be the go home to your kids at your local homestead every day. And that's how I like to live my life. I prefer not to be on the road. So I think that the folks that we most appeal to as an employer are the folks that want that sort of lifestyle where they're really centrally located here in Central New York.
100%. So you mentioned company culture, and I think that's important. I know when I arrived almost 4 years ago, and I remember my first day coming to the building for the interview. And I walked in and just like the peace, it was so quiet. And I was like, this is interesting. Because immediately to your point, you think construction. So you think like there's things going around and people moving around, but that wasn't the case. And
well, people just scream over their email now. They don't.
Right. That's what it is. But yet to your point, being more family oriented, do you think that company culture of appealing to those who want to be able to go home to their families stems from how your company started and you guys being not only a company or a corporation, but you're a family-owned business? Do you feel that plays a role?
It's funny. I was in a conversation with B. Gonzalez recently about some Central New York Community Foundation business we're both working on. And we're talking about, the notion of an organization feeling like a family. She and I were having a laugh saying there's a lot of different kinds of families. There's a lot of dysfunctional families too.
Right.
But maybe that's part of, what makes any organization great, right? That you're always going to be a bit of a warts and all organization. And the vibe that you have with your coworkers and with the subcontractors and the owners and the client base that you develop, you know, it's a small town. It is a warts and all town, and that you tend to know everybody's business. And we all fail and succeed, I think, largely as a region. And you feel that more in a town the size of Syracuse. And for better or for worse, I think that sense of family, that's a good thing. Not only in that, well, yeah, you're an accepted, embraced member of this family. Well, yeah, you're also accepted because we realize that the ups and downs of this business, the ups and downs of this economy, the ups and downs of this life, that's all part of being a family. That's all part of, you know, at times being dysfunctional, but you're still a family at the end of the day, right?
Yeah, so. I definitely had my dysfunctional moments.
Don't we all?
But we made it through that process. And I believe, in all honesty, that is one of the main reasons. Sure. And the value system being aligned, I think when people go to work for companies, it's important for them to get to do their research and or at least within the first year, be very attentive to that type of culture, if that's what you're seeking. Yep. And when your missions and your values align, it's such a easy fit.
Sure.
You know, and that's why I was so happy to actually be there from the beginning.
People define quality of life in a lot of different ways, right? I know that the compensation that a Huber Brewer can offer is only one piece of the puzzle.
Right.
And there, at any time, someone could probably, people have left Huber Brewer to go take a higher paying job in Manhattan. And I get that. Part of what I think appeals to people in terms of the family of Huber Brewer or any other similar organization is that it also aligns with your quality of life expectations. You know, that you want to be in this region. You're here because not only does Huber Brewer fit your work lifestyle, but Syracuse and Central New York fits your family lifestyle, your quality of life expectations, all those things. And that's why we put so much emphasis, I think, on being part of that local fabric. Because, yeah, if you're happy in Syracuse, hopefully you'd be happy working at Huber Brewer.
Right. So you mentioned your dad, Jim Brewer, and him pretty much being sort of like the pillar of when the company was able to start taking off in the 80s. And then you guys were on the south side.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because you are on the south side of Syracuse in a residential area. And I just love this story. And I think it's so important that it wasn't always a building. Your dad grew up over there on that end. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know the exact date when the highway was built, but Route 81, I'm going to guess it was the early 60s. Eisenhower, right? That most of that would have been built. But at the time that the highway was built, that was essentially kind of the farmland suburbs of downtown Syracuse. So prior to some of the tract housing and some of the multifamily residential that's gone up around us, that was literally, you know, urban farmland with a small farmhouse on it. And my dad has an older sister and a younger sister. His older sister, Pat, like largely grew up in that farmhouse. About the time my father was born, shortly thereafter, they tore that farmhouse down. My great-grandfather at the time and my grandfather who worked for him decided then to start building what is now our office. And I think as my great-grandfather had some financial successes, he would always put some of the money back into the facility. You know, always add on to the warehouse, add on to the facility. And so there was a time where we filled a lot more of that warehouse with our own tools and equipment because we were self-performing a lot more work in the 70s and 80s. The deliverable has changed, but the location has remained. And we kind of recommitted to it maybe 10 years ago when we did our last renovation there. I'm glad we did. Number one, it's tremendously accessible to University Hill and even just to jump on the highway, Future Boulevard, right? Up into downtown. But I like the recommitment to the south side. It's not the best neighborhood, but it's not the worst neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a bit of a reminder when you have to tell your employees, we're going to put up these street signs to remind our folks we're not going to exceed 20 miles per hour on this residential street. And, you know, just to be able to drive past the kids who are always playing on the street and know that, you know, you're in this for the community as much as you are for the financial well-being of the Brewer family and the many people who work for us. This is still our hopefully down home, down to earth location.
Right. So. And taking care of the space that you're in. Huber Brewer did, we at the time.
Was sure. The you get credit for that.
That's right. The Beautify Berwyn project.
Well, I'm sure you'll agree that the most rewarding parts of that are that once you start to spur a little bit of excitement and action into the street, You get people volunteering to do a little more.
Exactly.
Especially
the people who live there.
Sure.
Right. The people who live there and thinking about, okay, again, going back to community impact and being able to see the results or the return of investment, whether that be time, whether it be in-kind donations or something financially or fixing the sidewalk.
Right.
You know, that return on investment of that is exactly what you're saying.
Home Headquarters has done such a good job with that model with their Block Blitz, right?
Right.
We participated in those over the years and goes a long way to just improve the curb appeal of a street. And it means a lot, I think, in people having pride and confidence in their homes and in their street.
When you think about leadership and the climb, it was interesting to find out that you had actually worked for Huber Brewer, starting with, you mentioned something in a conversation we had about sweeping, like you
were even sweeping floors and hanging doors since 94.
Right, exactly. I think that people think when there's some sort of like nepotism, obviously, to having a family-owned business,
and sometimes it's just,
hand it over. Because I know that is one of the biases or even the thoughts that I had is just like, because you watch TV or you see the movies, and then it's just like, okay, well, here, now's the company.
Someday this will all be yours.
Exactly. But that process for you guys was like, you have to earn that, even though you know that might be coming down the line, is something that you have to earn. Would you agree? And what was that like?
I think you can talk about nepotism in a lot of ways, but certainly it was the case with my father coming up and me coming up that there was an expectation that you were going to work these job sites. In addition to the obvious work ethic, when I think back to, you know, some of the guys who still work for us that I worked alongside and worked for, you know, was sweeping those floors at the direction of a superintendent who I would later, you know, hope to manage. There's great humility and mobility in that. You know, honestly, at the age 21, 22, I was living in Atlanta and I had a good job working with a real estate developer that I'd been introduced to that employer when I was a senior in college. And I mean, Atlanta was hopping. This was, you know, this is 2001. Things were, you know, the Olympics had been there in 96. It was kind of, I feel like Atlanta kind of peaked and actually is really struggling even since then to get back to, I think they kind of peaked about the time of the Olympics, but it was a great place to be in 2001, but it still was never home. And I think at the time I probably had some ego about the fact that it was, quote, given to me, because I didn't understand enough at the time how hard you had to work just to maintain the status quo, you know, because my father did a pretty good job of just always putting his nose down and doing
it.
And so it was somewhat was hidden to me. I knew the work ethic of working, you know, 40 hours a week pushing a broom for Huber Brewer, but I didn't know the grind of, you know, you're only as strong as your next project. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of eat what you kill. And I know that now, you know, 21 years after coming back. But at 19 years old, you know, when you're more worried about, you know, finishing college and chasing girls, it's a totally different mindset. You're not thinking about what it takes to maintain a business. So it was humbling, I think, to come back. But I remember specifically being at a Christmas party. I came back sometime in the middle of my college career, as a junior, senior in college, and meeting one of those superintendents at the Huber Brewer Christmas party, who, of course, I had worked for pushing a broom 4 or 5 years prior to that. And he's saying, when are you coming back? I'm like, well, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. He's like, well, of course you're going to. It was almost like, of course you're coming back. Yeah? And it wasn't as dead set in my mind as it seemed to be with some of the folks who just assumed that I would. But 9/11 was a game changer for me in terms of proximity to family. That was probably as much an emotional response at the time to come back.
Yes.
As I'm sure, you know, other people in a million other ways had similar responses.
Yeah. Right. But I think that changed the dynamics and of a lot of people actually in deciding what they were going to do. And most people decided I wanted to be closer. They wanted to be closer to home. So the other thing that I find interesting that you said before I say that, and I just wanted to make sure everybody knew which college you went to.
I went to Emory.
You went to Emory University.
Which was great. Really loved Emory and highly recommend it. Growing up in Central New York, and I'd gone to school in New England for a couple of years before college. So I felt like I'd kind of had the more rural experiences. And I looked at the opportunity to go south, probably in the back of my mind, subconsciously, I was saying, well, I'll probably eventually return to the Northeast. Mm-hmm. So let's do something different for a while. And got to play lacrosse all over the Southeast. So I've been to Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and Oxford, Mississippi, and you know, Tallahassee and Jacksonville and all these places that I might not get a chance to ever go back to, but I feel like I saw all the Southeast. So that was great. And Atlanta was a great place to be 20 years old, that's for sure. And shortly after the Olympics, it was just, everything was spanking new. So it was a great place. And my wife's from north of Atlanta near Cartersville, Georgia.
Amy. And yeah, she's so amazing. I love her.
She's so beautiful. Well, she went to school down in Mercer, Georgia, at Mercer College in Macon, Georgia, which is south of Atlanta. So we still have a lot of reasons to get back and see how that city's grown.
That's good.
Yeah.
So you said something. You said you're only as good as your next project.
True.
So true. So yeah. You think 150 years, or even if you're starting it from the 80s, but that's something I learned and I realized, like, the chase is always happening, no matter how successful you may be.
A lot of balls in the air all the time.
Right.
It's funny. We met with a subcontractor not too long ago who was in the midst of a succession plan. And it's really hard to put like a valuation on a construction company for that exact reason. You know, it's like, you have obviously physical value of the buildings you own and
right.
maybe the equipment you own. We don't have a lot of equipment. It's like, we have a fleet of bulldozers and excavators, and we don't even really have a big fleet of trucks. So we don't have really a ton of equipment that has value. What has value is our people, and what has value is our pipeline. But the pipeline is never for certain until you got that signed contract. And
right.
these days, any number of things can knock that out of whack, right? You got financing issues and cost escalation and, you know, institutional work that they say, well, we're just going to wait a couple of years to do this. We're just going to see how things settle in for one reason or another. So yeah, you're always in the chase, and you've seen it. You look at our pre-construction mm-hmm. list at any given time, and there's 30 or 40 things on there, and they're try to grade them based on the likelihood of them coming to fruition. And
right.
some days, you know, it comes together just the way you think it will. And
some days,
other weeks you're like, I don't know how that went so wonky, but we just wasted a lot of time on that.
Right. That's actually something that I picked up, though, from being there. Believe me, I was a student a lot. I know I had some things to offer as well, but definitely a student was the forecasting.
Sure.
That forecasting is important. It is key. And I know with a lot of startups or people who are just like getting started, it might be something that they might hear of, or you might talk about it as a topic, but it doesn't get focused on a lot. And when I'm thinking about the keys to success or how to maintain,
yeah.
that forecasting is so important, and having the ability to do that.
I think the fits and starts with any, you know, entrepreneurial venture, it's so hard to manage. And then you get in a certain groove where you come to rely on something that isn't necessarily assured for the next year, the next season, whatever it might be. So that is absolutely the biggest challenge. There's other challenges, certainly, that are specific to New York State, especially with mm-hmm. with our business, you know, in terms of barriers to entry, which is great if you're an established firm, but very difficult as an entrepreneur. But I think you're right that the pipeline piece of it is very hard. And especially when you're chief cook and bottle washer for a startup business, right? And you're the guy who's doing the books, who's also performing the work.
Yes, that's where I'm at right now.
Yes, you are. So you're living it, and you're—
I'm living it right now. And to be honest, I'm like, I think I'm about to go back to work. This is so hard. And I was a fake serial entrepreneur. I was not a serial entrepreneur from my 20s. So I would love to say, oh, well, I've been running businesses or trying. No, those were hustles. Yeah. That was not actually running business. Now I'm running a business. I have an actual company. And when I tell you, of course, because I'm older and I've had more experiences sure. over the years, but it's tough.
But you and I have talked about this enough. You have these different sectors, things that are all interesting to you because you're such a Renaissance woman, right?
Right.
And the challenge for you, and we've had discussion, it's like, you know, the distraction factor. Which one of these are you going to remain interested enough in? Not because you're uninterested in the future, but because you have all these other interests in terms of, you know, business pursuits in different sectors. And you hope that you create enough of a macrocosm that these things all start to overlap. By getting there, it's hard to stay committed. And I'm involved with construction technology in Rochester, construction robotics. And, you know, we call it the squirrel syndrome. We say to our founder, Scott, it's like, don't, you know, that squirrel that's got you distracted, don't go chasing that to create a new custom solution with that.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Stay with our core technology, stay with our business. And yes, yeah, so you got to mind the squirrels.
Yeah. And no matter how, again, successful you get, you're always going to be there in that space, because you're always chasing
at every
the
level.
Next, at There's, every
even
level.
At, you know, peer groups mean a lot to people. I don't belong to really an official peer group, like a YPO or something, but at the highest levels of business, I think people still seek that out because the parity of the challenges that people are going through. I think that you don't want to feel like you're whining. You just want to be able to talk to somebody who can really appreciate that struggle and who may have already gone through it or maybe soon to go through it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's value to peer groups and that sort of leadership development, no doubt.
And consistent leadership. What are some things that leadership development, thank mm-hmm. you, for yourself, what are some things that you do to maintain and support your development?
Probably the most routine thing that I'm involved with. We self-insure a few lines of our insurance coverage through a captive, which is an awful boring way of saying that we're really like a small percentage of our own insurance company. And as a result, a couple times a year, we get to meet with the leadership of that captive. And so I'm drawing from you know, other leaders of like-sized and similar construction organizations from around the country, and none of whom are really my direct competitors in this geographic marketplace. So just the opportunity to kind of share, vent with folks and, you know, the challenges of how New York struggles of, you know, doing business here. Mm-hmm. And you, then you go and talk to somebody in California, like, oh, well, at least we don't have to deal with that issue. You know, throw some drought or some earthquake on top of that as an insurance risk management factor, things like that. So I don't know. I kind of use that as probably my best peer group in terms of something I'm routinely doing. But otherwise, I think that I get the most, I don't know, leadership development out of my work with not-for-profits, you know, boards and things that I'm on, where you get to draw little pieces of influence and expertise from folks you get to sit on a board with. So I could say that about Community Foundation or about Center State or about the Landmark Theater, ESF Foundation. I love being in those kind of, you know, those kind of circles, because you're putting people who aren't necessarily in the same sector around a common table where you're trying to solve problems on behalf of an organization that you all have passion for. Mm-hmm. So that's how I look at leadership development, kind of day to day, month to month.
Right. I'm glad you mentioned board. I know here it's like saturated. I've seen people sit on like 9 different boards, and I don't understand how they could be so effective.
You can't.
On 9 different boards, you know.
Unfortunately, I learned it firsthand, and I'm doing a better job of saying no for that exact reason. If you want to be an effective contributor, there's figurehead boards and then there's working boards. The Landmark Theater, which is probably the one that's nearest and dearest to me at this moment, it is a truly working board. You know, it is a volunteer-led organization. And it's in some ways the hardest work, and the flip side of it's the most gratifying, because you feel like you've actually helped shape that organization. But I really feel for these people who feel they have to say yes to 7, 8, 9 boards.
Oh my gosh. You know? The power of no. Remember when I started getting all those requests for the different boards? And then you and Julie were like, okay, you need to really think about this. But I did take that back. And so the same for me. It's just, you want to be effective. And when you're on a board, it's another role of leadership in a way.
Absolutely.
And I realized it's not just about giving money, right? You don't have to, giving money is great, but you would think that if you're a board member, you have to have some sort of like money in order to do that, because these organizations need money to run. But no, sure. your intellect, your skill set is just as much value. And in being in these spaces.
For me, I think that board participation, it puts a face and a name, I think, to every other organization in town. I think it's very easy when you're not involved with boards to blame some problem on some nameless organization that you've never been a part of. I think that, you know, we've been involved with Vera House over the years. I can really empathize, I think, with the average board member at Vera House with some of the leadership struggles they've gone through the last couple of years. And say, like, you know, at the end of the day, there's still a board that's comprised of good people in this community who are there, you know, to dedicate their time, talent, or treasure. And you empathize with them, you know, because you know you've sat on boards where, maybe not to that degree, but there's been a leadership challenge or a financial challenge, you know, but for the goodwill of all these people who are willing to contribute to these boards, where would these organizations be? And so it helps, I think, with your empathy almost on a national level, you know, that boards are people too.
Boards are people too. Yes. I was going to say something, but I want to say into all of this was corporation. There was corporations are people too.
That's
and
right.
It was a big hoopla around that.
That's for sure.
Once upon a time. But anyway.
It's a little bit different, I think, with for-profit.
With for-profit. Yes, exactly. It's moving on to an important question that when I had shared in a group that I'd be interviewing today, and like, what would they be interested in knowing? We covered a lot of that in some of your responses already, but what made you guys decide to initially say, you know what, we need a community outreach person? And DEI came after that, but what was it that made you say, this is important to our company, we're going to have someone do this?
Yeah. I don't think it wasn't a lightning bolt so much as it was the growth of what I think our identity in the community's always been. You know, I talked earlier about how we've been more wed to this geography and doing the right things by this community and creating a quality of life for our employees that is specific to this region. And a lot of that comes with, you know, doing business for repeat clients, some of whom are going to be, you know, not-for-profits or municipal clients who are either going to have soft or hard goals around DEI. And then I think just in general, the way we contribute in some ways philanthropically, financially, or with volunteer time, you always hope you can do more. And I don't necessarily know that it was, you know, national politics or there being more of a pronounced need of it so much as just kind of the convergence of, this is what we see in Syracuse. This is what we need. It was absolutely shaped by other organizations. You know, CNY Works is a tenant in a building that we've done a bunch of work in Franklin Square. obviously we're very active with Center State CEO and with Dr. Rogers and others. They obviously put the right emphasis on this at the right time, and they are certainly local, you know, leaders in that space. But then also all these community labor training organizations that we've worked with over the years. It just seemed to be there was this convergence of all these factors at that time. And you couple that with, you know, working at a Syracuse City school where mm-hmm. where you got a little bit more of a up close look at challenges and poverty, and even the location of our office on the south side. At some point, things just become so apparent. You say, how do we help move the needle? Mm-hmm. And as you and I have discussed, it's a both and, right? You got to mm-hmm. do it all. There's the traditional ways I think that we've contributed to the community, and then there's a more targeted effort around DEI. And some of that is self-serving, right? It's that we are doing municipal projects, City of Syracuse, New York State, County of Onondaga, that are going to have a hard goal.
Right.
But others is listening to a Syracuse Community Health Center who says, we want to employ folks from the neighborhood. That's a soft goal that is complementary to maybe the Department of Health saying, hey, Community Health Center, you have to have this to get your funding.
Right.
But both are important to that client. I guess the short answer is it's listening to our clients and it's observing what's all around us in our community. And it's a slog, as you know, right? You've lived it with us trying to move that needle.
Yes, yes. Question about when we talk about DEI, because I do want to touch on that a little bit.
Sure.
Like, I know we focus on community, but I think the DEI piece is really, really important. Most folks, I feel like when they think about DEI, they think about just race alone. We've talked about this and whether or not companies should have a DEI person. Or is it more about the company having more support and pushing boundaries and bringing the topic of bias and biases into this space?
You try to determine where the need really is, right? And like where what you're trying to address first. And from our perspective, I mean, we even look at, I'll say, the glass ceiling from a gender stereotype in construction as a sector, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe one of the most demonstrative things that I can do first is to just do a better job of looking at the females in our organization and saying, all right, am I being fair to the women just to bring them up to the same level of opportunity as some of the men? I think as a sector in general, and especially in Central New York, traditionally, the guys swinging hammers on construction sites are more rural people who've lived. I mean, as I look at the workforce, the guys who work in our job site, they're coming from Mexico Parish, Oswego County, Lafayette. It's not necessarily traditionally has been an urban workforce. Just those, I don't know, micro checks on how you look at the person next to you. And am I even rising, you know, giving that opportunity to that person or making those small adjustments in how we look at our recruitment. That goes a long way, I think,
with
addressing it. Because to go and make the leap to, I'll say, racial DEI, right? As you and I have talked about, it's like, yeah, that's an even further challenge within the sector,
right?
Within the professional community of Central New York. And you and I think agree that, like, you know, when I look at an organization our size and the work that we do, it in some cases almost too big of a leap to start to say, well, why don't we have more people of color in this office? Like, let's start with the things that we need to do first.
Right. And for me, with the struggle was being a Black woman in that space surrounded by so much whiteness, is I had to also dig in and say, it's me trying to get my coworkers and my leadership to be me and understand is extremely impossible.
Right.
And prioritize, it's not that it's not going to happen, mm-hmm. but obviously it would have been my first priority and something I wanted to push. But if we talk about it, like, we having those uncomfortable and tough conversations about, like, well, how do we get here so that we know what's important to everyone, and that how all your employees, regardless of their race and what they are important and valuable, which is why I stayed. When you went through the stuff I brought in and kept me there, because I could always say I could have quit and I could have been fired. It was always that, but I feel like we had always been aligned again on our values and
That's very well said.
Yeah, not just for the company, but for our community and also the impact and change we want to make in the workplace culture.
Right.
Right.
For humanity.
For humanity in general. Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming to a close of the interview. Andy, you have to give me three of your top values or character traits that are important to you.
I mean, honesty's got to be at the top of it, right? Be honest with your capabilities. You know, you talked about values. I think that the word value in and of itself, like, put yourself in places where you add value. Don't try to be who you're not. And that, I guess, it goes hand in hand with honesty. But we always say that we don't want to force ourselves into construction roles where we don't add value. And I think the last one is something I'm always trying to remind myself, which is, I'll say innovation, but I guess progression is probably a better word, that to give a little deference to the generation that's coming up, give a little extra consideration to that technology that could help you work a little smarter, just progression. So how about that? Honesty, adding value, and being mindful of progression. Yeah.
Great. I love those. Well, thank you again so much, ladies and gentlemen. This is the end of our podcast. I thank you too for taking the time to sit and listen to this interview. If you have any thoughts or ideas, please feel free to email me at Lakia@LakiaTechLLC.com with those ideas for podcast interviews and guests. Bye.